The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoon Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy.
So welcome to Secure in Mind. Today, I have an extremely special guest. I have known this gentleman for over 10 years. He is one of the most impressive individuals I've had the pleasure to know and, know over an expanse of time and share war stories and everything from professional to personal and everything in between. He's a fantastic guy who I respect a huge amount. His background and CV is incredible. He's military, where he reached the lofty heights of, colonel in the United States Air Force. He was the Director for Cyber Operations at the United States Cyber Command. He was also Chief of Staff at the Department of Homeland Security, the United States National Cybersecurity Center. On top of that, he has a plethora of private sector roles where he has been coordinating and managing multi-billion dollar budgets and doing a whole lot of very, very, very crazy things in cyber operations, military, private, etc. So please welcome Steve Horns.
Thanks, Nick. It's a pleasure to be here, and I owe you a big lager for that warm introduction. You certainly, it's been a pleasure knowing you and all these years and commiserating in all of our adventures in cyber. What can I do? What can we talk about today, my friend?
All righty. There's so much. look, where to begin? I mean, the podcast, I generally, the listeners really identify with the human behind policy. That's become a bit of a mantra. It should be the slogan. So first things first, I like to sort of walk through the background, get a sense of, how you came to where you are. And that's, it can be a mixture of personal, professional, were your parents in the military. So give us a nice rundown and set the stage for, for who you are.
Sure. Just for your listeners, I'm actually speaking to you from Washington, D.C., and we have lovely weather today. My background goes back to growing up in a small village in Ohio, the state of Ohio, and my family, most of my family was in the Army, actually, and going back to the Great War, and I broke rank and went into the Air Force because I got a better deal. I decided that I liked working with computers and technology. Actually, I wanted to be a pilot, but I grew too tall. For your listeners, I'm just under 2 meters.
Wow.
So I wanted to be a pilot, but too tall. So got into telecommunications, IT, SATCOM, long haul. So the majority of my career was spent, on the networking side, both telecom and IT. I've been all over the world, as have you. And spent a lot of time in Europe. I was in both the Mediterranean as well as spent some time in the UK. I was in the Pacific, Japan, Korea, et cetera. And towards the end of my career, I was at a place called Defense Information Systems Agency, which is in effect provides tier one global communications capability, SATCOM and terrestrial for DOD. And I had always been security, as you know, is a part of everything. Security is not separated. Security is a part of all communications technologies. So I had always been around security. So for me, cyber didn't start like in the last, 10, 20 years, what we call cyber. I have always been engaged in information security. It just became called cyber towards the end of my career. I was asked to lead the tier one DOD, Department of Defense, Global Network Operations and Security Center. And that was my first real assignment into what we now call cyber. And I ran the Network Operations Center, which in effect was the security, a SOC, Security and, Operations Center.
And Steve, so this was the first, as you say, SOC of its kind within that department, was it?
Yes. Yeah. It was the in essence, what we did was we monitored the largest military network in the world. We had all commands, all networks, both classified and unclassified, as well as academia, medical, you know, these other parts of the military community, shall we say. And so we had 64 different commands that we monitored at the tier one level, the interface between the military network and the open intranet.
And to give people a size of scale, especially people who haven't been in military, how many people would 64 commands equate to, more or less?
So if you include all the civilians and contractors, it was around 6 million people.
So for everyone listening who's running a SOC, who's looking at 6 million people, that's a lot of communication.
And as you can imagine, this was a tiered level of SOCs. There was, you know, we were at the tier one level and all the different commands had their own SOCs. But in effect, we monitored, reported into the National Military Command Center. Yeah. We reported status of the entire military network from a cyber perspective.
Okay, so and also tier one was, did it escalate upwards or downwards? Because sometimes...
The vernacular, I understand that. So what we called tier one was at the top, and then tier two, and then tier three. In some cases, tier three from a service perspective is at the top. But in our case, tier one was the top of the pyramid.
Gotcha. Okay, and which year was this?
That would have been around 2006. Okay. And then shortly after that, after about a year or two of that, there was planning in the background going on in regards to cyber. There had been some fairly substantial successful cyber attacks against DoD infrastructure, and we needed some deconfliction between the offensive and the defensive side. At that time, this was around 2007, the offensive side was what was called a Joint Task Force Network Warfare. So at the time, it was actually labeled network warfare, and that was being conducted out of National Security Agency, NSA, up in Maryland. And we were on the defensive side, network operations, network defense. And sometimes you get into a problem where the offensive side has some capabilities resident in a network downrange, and now you're trying to do things to turn off that network downrange. And so this Intel ops loss gain, as you've heard before, you get into this problem where the offensive side is calling you up and saying, "Hey, you know, what are you doing? You're turning off my capabilities." And so a lot of planning, a lot of discussion, a lot of behind the scenes planning, which culminated in myself being asked to take a team up to Fort Meade, knock on the door and say, "Hey, the defense is here." And that was the beginning of the formation of what we now today call U.S. Cyber Command. Yeah. At the time, we basically put together a cell where offense and defense started sitting together, started planning, and actually started talking to each other.
which, I mean, it's a really, really good example of where there can be friction from the same side. You know, if you've got operations which are running, and if you've got a covert mission that is going to be jeopardized by another portion of your of the military, but a different entity which doesn't have the communication, they're going to switch off the lights, and that's going to jeopardize your mission, right?
So. Right, and a lot of that was happening. This is during, you know, some of the operations that were going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, and so it was very critical. Some of these operations were chasing known, you know, terrorist cells, etc. And so, in some cases, had we executed our defensive operation, we could have impacted the network infrastructure that was supporting those operations. So it was a legitimate call to get the offensive defense together. And so we started forming the team, and I got engaged in, you know, the operations and operational assessments. How are we doing? Are we actually achieving the outcomes that we anticipate? And then after that, they actually asked me to go over to DHS, Department of Homeland Security, who was starting to form the national cyber security capability, and the CERT, the national U.S. CERT. And so I was the senior military liaison over at DHS, Department of Homeland Security, and what I called the Big Six, which was six governmental agencies, DOD, NSA, CIA, FBI, DOJ, and DHS, what we call the Gang of Six, to start really forming a relationship of information sharing. And today we call those the ISACs, the intergovernmental and private sector, as well as national, as well as international, as you know, sharing cyber information. Yeah. And the U.S. CERT stood up. So I did that for about a year. And then they asked me to consider going back to Iraq. And I said, I have, you know, no interest. So I retired.
Wonder why.
Yeah. Well, I had a 1 year old at the time. And, you know, mom gets a vote.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I do have a question. With the construction of the U.S. Cyber Command.
Sure.
Obviously, that was the first cyber initiative where you're pulling together red team or blue team, defense, offense, so that you can discuss the overall strategy without jeopardizing either and also complementing each. Was that as a result of, and not digging too much into detail, was it a result of a number of failures on that behalf, or was that based on lessons learned from prior years, which weren't so much cyber related, but maybe similarly affected by a lack of communication between offense and defense?
I would say yes to all the above. I think in certain cases you had military services off doing certain operations in cyber that may have been coordinated at a, let's say, regional command level, but was not known at the national level. And at that time, cyber was considered a part of intelligence, not necessarily operations at the time.
Yeah.
And the authorities were held very tightly regarding cyber operations. In fact, at that time, it was really considered information warfare and not so much network warfare or cyber. It was a part of information operations. And so the authorities for that were held very tightly. They have since been relaxed. As you know, now Cyber Command is its own command with its own authorities and its own budget. But at the time, it was very closely held. In fact, in order to get in the door, I had to take a polygraph just to be able to conduct operations. So the lessons learned there were that in order to achieve the effects, the outcome that a combatant commander wants, it needs to be coordinated, just like air power, just like naval power, just like land power. It needs to be coordinated. And special operations were engaged. Some of our other government agencies on the intelligence community were engaged. So there was a lot of activity that was going on, but it wasn't coordinated. Yeah. Cyber Command really, in many cases, was put together as a command that could start to coordinate all these activities and to start to focus them on specific operations and ensure that there was no collateral damage, friendly fire, collateral damage.
Mm-hmm. For people in the private sector, it's almost like a PMO, right?
Sort of. Yeah. Except much bigger.
It's like slightly bigger, 64 commands, 6 million.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So, look, I think listeners will certainly get a sense of just the sheer scale that we're talking about. So let's jump into it. United States Cyber Command, we've sort of picked apart some of the aspects. You and I were talking before the show about some areas that we can focus on.
Right.
Give me an understanding of what the latest is of United States Cyber Command, how it's evolved, how it's separated from the NSA, and a number of other, the pointers that we were discussing.
Sure. I'll try to run through it very, very briefly because I know that there's a lot there to talk about. But I think some things that are interesting to note is in the 10 years since my involvement in standing up Cyber Command, there has been a relaxation of even the discussion. In the initial strategy, the word offensive wasn't even included. There was no discussion of the offensive side for fear of international community reaction and also just trying to keep close hold of the capabilities that we had. As you know, there's been even a compromise at NSA and some of the tools were released. In fact, there's been two compromises. Mm-hmm. And so there has been some unfortunate collateral damage associated with that. But in the most recent strategy, you've evolved from not talking about it to now talking about it quite succinctly. And the strategy is called Defend Forward. And what that means is rather than just defending at your gate, what we're going to do is to put our capabilities out into the international networks, into other networks, and maintain persistent presence and, in effect, try to deter or defend against adversary cyber capabilities on their network rather than on our network.
And you can obviously, and just jumping in there, you can see how the fact that cyber was sort of considered in the intelligence realm as opposed to the military realm, that that may impact that openness. So, for example, years ago, Kinetic, you know, we're going to talk about the Kinetic offensive capabilities or the offensive mission. Maybe not all, maybe, you know, there are a number of coverts, but it was still out in the open a lot more than the cyber portion was. It took that, that took a while for that to evolve, didn't it? And what else made up part of the cyber strategy and makes up part of the cyber strategy?
So I mentioned persistent presence, which obviously is a piece of that, in order to understand adversary intent. And I, you know, I'll make a comment here. I think we may talk about this. We may circle back on this, but intelligence from a point of view of the military perspective, I'm somewhat of a naysayer when it comes to this. I have found that it's very, very difficult to actually receive and capture true intelligence on the cyber side. And by true intelligence, this sector is being targeted. This group is responsible. We think this type of vector is affecting these type of systems. That's all retrospective and it's all information. What I'm talking about is this group is going to produce or is producing this particular piece of malware that will be targeted at this sector. We think these are the actions that need to be taken ahead of time to defend yourself against that. That's intelligence. And what I found is I think the reason why there is this focus on persistent presence is persistent presence gives you an improved opportunity to gather intelligence. In the past, there was a significant problem in gathering true intelligence on the intent and capabilities. And the other P that goes along is we've mentioned persistent engagement, persistent presence is persistent innovation. I think it's well known that in cyber technology, the evolution of technology occurs very rapidly. And in Cyber Command, we found that there's slow procurement cycle, slow acquisition cycle, slow development cycle, and you're constantly behind the curve. And so one of the focuses in Cyber Command is ramping up its ability to rapidly create new capabilities. And if you look at the adversary landscape, in effect, I think what Cyber Command has been trying to do is to mimic that, because adversaries are able to maneuver very quickly and put capability and technology out there very rapidly. And so I think that's another area where Cyber Command has been focused.
And just to press on that and unpick that a bit regarding, say, the cyber presence, for example, and collaboration with different methods of intelligence gathering, Cyber Command would then act as, the centrifuge for bits of intelligence that you're getting from human intelligence, for example. A couple of things spring to mind when you have people who have infiltrated, say, a forum in, let's pick a country, Brazil, and it's quite renowned in the dark market for creating some quick and easy but effective malware kit. Also, there's an element of necessity where you would have to have people on the ground, right? Who, because some of the development might happen outside of internet connected forums. So those types of intel or that type of intel would also be useful to send back to command to make the types of strategic decisions. Is that correct as well?
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that. There is this, there's been over the past year, recent discussions on the fact that certain groups out there that are in developing stage of malware are actually disconnected and closed off. And so there's been this lot of discussion of closed networks, and the development side is now closed off from any access from the internet. And so there are companies out there, including the military, that now sort of somewhat advertise that they have boots on the ground in the target space. And the human, the signals intelligence, listening to other sources of communication, monitoring dark web, monitoring chat forums, monitoring blogs, etc., in order to gather a wider range of intelligence. This disconnectedness has led to, just as an aside, has led to a resurgence in the discussion of using electronic warfare and information warfare as an avenue, a vector to access these closed networks. The Israelis were really good at this. If you go back and look at Israeli cyber history, and I think you probably know that better than I do, the Israelis are very good at using electronic warfare-based systems, electronic warfare, to penetrate cyber systems and to achieve effects in that way. And so there's been a lot of discussion here. And there are companies now that advertise that they actually have a human network that is a part of their threat intelligence gathering process. They have boots on the ground. They have people that are close to these sources. The only thing that I would say that I take caution in that is the adversary knows this. If you're advertising it, therefore I know it. Therefore, I'm going to be even more cautious. So I the thing I can't comment on, because I'm not inside that community, is the results. Is it working? It's one thing to advertise it. It's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing. Okay, great. What are the results? I think it would be interesting for you to potentially in another blog in the future to maybe have that as a topic of discussion and try to find companies that are in that space and sort of challenge them on the results of their efforts in that area, intelligence gathering against closed networks.
There is one company, I won't name them because I don't want to endorse them, but they did get acquired, and I mean they had a great team with them. That their selling point was exactly that: boots on the ground, mixture, all background in intel. The results, well, you know, the philosophy of the result. We'll see. We'll get into that discussion in a bit. But has it had any impact? Well. But that's for the later in the discussion. And then you mentioned persistent innovation, and I guess, just to summarize your point there, it's basically saying that it would be ridiculously fast rate of innovation and change in technology cyber command has to keep up.
Correct. There is now, as you know, there are systems out there. Using data analytics, using automation that now are, in effect, creating variants of malware beyond human speed. Yeah. And so there is a need for traditional military operations, which is very closed and very tightly controlled. I think what's been happening is there's been a loosening up in that area to allow a greater mixture of people to enter into that community and contribute. In the past, it was a very closed community and primarily controlled by the military and intel, and they were just not keeping up.
Yeah. And you see, I mean, a classic example, people who are in the know and who sort of follow tools that are released, NSA just released Ghidra, which is a competitor to IDA, for example, for reverse engineering malware. Now, I don't know, even 5 years ago, that would have been it's just absolutely no. Whereas now they've open sourced it. That sits on GitHub, and it's a good way of talent, you know, the finding talent as well.
Right.
And also, you know, when you're conducting a job interview as an intel agency, someone might know EDA, but then they also use your tool as well. But just the change, because 5 years ago, absolutely not. You would not find that anywhere in GitHub unless it had been pilfered and then sold on the darknet. You're right. It's rapidly changing.
Yes.
When we talk about the development of tech, how much input does an entity like Cyber Command have on, I guess, investment in tools? And what I mean by that is, I guess, the connection that you would have with, say, a DARPA or an IARPA, or, for example, the money, the InQtel, that type of organization.
Yes, sure. Invested. So, interestingly, there is another command within the U.S. military called Special Operations Command.
Yep.
And because of what they do, they have their own budget because it's very unique. It speeds up the ability for them to buy. Yep. That same model has now been applied to U.S. Cyber Command. U.S. Cyber Command has, I think, somewhere in the range of $80 to $100 million of their own money controlled by them at their authority level to buy tools, to buy capabilities, and to even hire people. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in recent congressional testimony, the commander of Cyber Command indicated that he was looking for additional opportunity to spend because he hadn't spent it all. But but the issue here is speed. Mm. It's not the money. The money is needed because it speeds up the process.
Yeah.
And by speeding up the process, Cyber Command is able to, in effect, put capability out there much more rapidly in response to either requirements from the field or requirements from the national level. And so the money really results in speed. And there's also procurement authorities, acquisition authorities, a lot of the meat and potatoes kind of things that have been delegated to them. And so Cyber Command now can conduct its own operations without requiring certain levels of permission. It can buy its own tools and leverage them very rapidly.
Mm. Okay. And how, taking all these pieces together, like the Cyber Command strategy, the operational strategy, a couple of points that you and I sort of noted were, I mean, the United States is in constant conflict in the cyberspace, and as you've noted, that's just below the threshold for war. How does this benefit United States in the sense, or how does this sit with the United States? Sorry, is a much
right
better phrase that because it's, you know, the nagging, the annoyance of sitting underneath the threshold of war when you know that it's chipping away. And what I mean by that is there are some nation states that shall remain nameless, maybe pilfering a lot of IP, maybe nipping at the heels quite readily, and yet, again, not enough to engage in armed kinetic conflict.
Right.
How has that changed policy? Has that been the catalyst for moving into that, okay, defense forward and even persistent presence, but also the admission of persistent presence? Has that been a catalyst for that?
Yeah, just the mention of persistent presence is intending to send a signal to, you know, adversaries that we are either inside your network or working hard to get inside your network. It's very insightful observation that you make there. In the beginning, none of this was even talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's being discussed. And I have in the past taken unpopular position, mm-hmm. which is the majority of what you just described, the penetration, the pilfering, capturing IP, my personal information that was held at the Office of Personnel Management was in effect stolen. You know, that is a crime. Now here's the unpopular position that I've taken.
Mm.
That is a crime. It's not war.
Yeah.
The majority, U.S. law, the majority of everything you just described is crime, not war. I take the position that if I am an adversary, I will never go to cyber war with you. I will always maintain my level of capability and the actions that I'm taking that are just below that threshold,
mm-hmm.
that never trigger an Article 5, you know, UN Charter, or et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And I will, and therefore, I argued in a paper I published that, for example, what Russia did against Estonia, what Russia did against Georgia, the country, you cannot attribute it to the government of Russia, although it's very closely linked. But it's not war; it's crime,
mm-hmm.
and therefore, Interpol rather than NATO should have been engaged.
Yeah.
We're very quick
yeah.
to start describing things in terms of cyber warfare.
Yeah.
When in fact in the current legal regiment, most of that is crime. Now what I will tell you is that things are changing. And what do I mean by that? A couple weeks ago, the US hosted the Japanese Ministry of Defense as well as the foreign ministry.
Mm.
And at the press briefing, the U.S. and Japan made the following statement, and I'll read it to you here. The United States and Japan affirm that international law applies in cyberspace and that attack could, in certain circumstances, constitute an armed attack under Article 5 of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty. Mm-hmm. So this treaty goes back to the 1960s. So what's happening is there has been this elevation of the recognition that if I take out your electric grid, if I take out a nuclear power station and it causes collateral damage, kinetic damage, if I do certain actions, it could elevate to the level of war, because if an aircraft flew over U.S. territory and bombed the nuclear power plant, that probably would raise the same level of concern.
Yeah.
So there has been an elevation within the diplomatic community that certain actions could raise to the level of war. So I will give you that.
Yeah.
But I will say that, generally speaking, those who have studied this and looked at papers from China, looked at papers from Russia, will tell you that, generally speaking, the first thing I'm not going to do is to attack you with a military uniformed person in cyber.
Yeah.
Because if I do not attack you with a military person in cyber, you cannot call it cyber war.
Yeah. Yeah. And not to mention, I mean, you look at the word steal, for example, or pilfer. It's criminal, but
it's criminal. So if you look at what happened against Georgia, the majority of cyber attacks against the country of Georgia were from sympathizers.
Yeah.
Sympathizers, you don't go to war against them.
Yeah.
So Cyber Command has a very difficult posture, in the sense that I personally have an unpopular opinion that we will never really truly go to cyber war.
Mm.
We will be at war, yes, but not cyber war.
Mm.
Because the only way you can go to cyber war is having warfare against, in effect, a government-sponsored, government-supported, uniformed force. And that's the last thing that China, Russia, North Korea, Iran are going to do against the U.S. They're going to disperse. They're going to keep it a non-governmental effort.
Do you think, maybe not cyber war, but let's say cyber skirmishes happen when you have a cat and mouse game with a highly specialized military unit that's fiddling in the network and you're trying to block them?
Absolutely. And I can tell you that I've personally been associated in those cyber skirmishes.
Yeah.
And yes, there are, not at the level of war, but at the level of, let's say that you have a particular cell that's recruiting for an ISIS effort. And in effect, you either want to take that down, or you want to disrupt it, or you want to conduct information against the people who are performing that operation. Certainly, those operations are ongoing all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a very, very complicated landscape, which brings us to the United States federal government. another complicated landscape. the president's 2020 budget request and cyber priorities. A couple of things, and I know there are a couple of points that we can probably get through here. First and foremost, though, there was one of my guests was J. Michael Daniel a while ago. There was a cybersecurity coordinator, and one of the first moves that the current administration did was to remove the cybersecurity coordinator, which many people who I talked to don't think that was the best move. What are your thoughts with the current administration? Obviously, you know, we never want to get too political, and yet if you do, feel free.
Right. So I consider myself, I've served in both administrations, Republican and Democrat. As a military person, I consider myself independent. So I generally don't get into the political side, because I look more at the actions rather than the politics.
Yeah.
So if you look at the actions, although the IT budget is down, because remember, we got to build a wall, there have been a significant increase in both cyber as well as artificial intelligence priorities.
Mm.
In terms of the characterization of the administration, there's a significant number of positions that are unfilled.
Mm.
And I don't know that the vacancy of a particular cyber position inside the administration has had significant impact, from my perspective, on the policy or the budget or a strategy. There have been strategies published. There's been policy published. There has been, you know, significant efforts made in things like technology modernization, significant amount of funding, cloud, significant policy to shift government organizations into cloud-based infrastructure, getting away from, you know, these silos of government-owned networks.
Yeah, and this is a massive job across the United States federal government with numerous federal departments. How do you, how do you see the trend being absorbed? If you take, for example, the Office of Personnel Management you mentioned before, that was a massive,
yeah,
a lot of records lost. Are things changing? Are we still wallowing in a sea of crap?
So one of the things that has changed is the Department of Defense is now responsible more so for a lot of the security background checks and the information associated with that.
Yep.
That was a significant change in strategy. There's also been significant push on the workforce side, both training as well as skills. I again have an unpopular position somewhat within the military, which is that these traditional certs that you see, like a CISSP, a CISM, CISA, et cetera, all of these general certs are very good, but they're not sufficient for government personnel in the sense that, especially on the operations side, cyber operations, there's no cert for that. You have to go experience it. The military is putting in place. In fact, I was in effect trained and certified in a specific position, and that training had nothing to do with commercial certs.
Yeah.
On the government side, there's a lot of push now. There's been a brain drain. The government, in terms of its both its budget as well as the salaries that it can pay, has not been able to keep up with industry. So there's been a significant brain drain. So the government recently announced in a presidential executive order an effort to establish a mechanism where those who are not currently in cyber but would like to be could have an avenue to change jobs, to switch careers, and to actually get government-sponsored training and potentially even have a tour over at DHS in the cert to get certified and then come back into your government agency to help them improve their cyber. Significant amount of effort also in getting away from compliance into risk-based models, risk-based management, the risk-based framework. And so a lot of continuous monitoring, continuous diagnostics, establishing a level of risk of your network, and then continuously diagnosing and monitoring it. Your insightful question was, what difference has it made? if you and I went out and Googled right now, any, you know, AT&T, IBM, CenturyLink, you know, Verizon, any of the major, Mandiant, any of the major cyber annual reports, you know, the annual report for 2018, 2019, they would all tell you that the threat is increasing, vulnerabilities are increasing, risk is increasing, and the number of successful attacks are increasing.
Yeah.
So I continue to, you know, have this, personal belief that you do need to take a look at it from a risk perspective, and there's a lot that we can do, but there has not been a significant change in the outcome. The tools haven't made a change. The certs haven't made a change. And I think it would be an interesting dialogue that you could have across your audience base for input on that. Nick, I'd like to turn the tables and kind of ask you, whenever I get on the podium in front of audiences, I always ask them, so what have you heard recently? No kidding. What have you heard recently that you think has made a significant change?
See, the philosopher in me likes to answer this with a very stoic response. If we go back 10,000 years and I had a rock and I threw it at you, all of a sudden I have a projectile, and then you pull a piece of bark up, block the rock, and then you get a bigger rock. And a couple of thousand years later, we've got swords, and then you have a sword, and then I have a bow and arrow so I can get you at length. Then you develop a spear, which means even, you know, maybe greater lethality. And then I develop something else, and then I develop something, you develop something else. The point about bringing it back in history is that nothing's changed within the last 40 years of cyber. nothing's changed within humanity for the last 10,000 years. We've still been adversaries who are developing things to defeat the other adversary with their different weapon advances. So the true philosopher in me thinks we are never going to win and we are never going to lose. And the key to happiness before, you know, in this nice space of time between life and death is to accept that reality, but not to be complacent and not to be resigned in a negative sense with that reality, but to accept it and even fight a fight because you may as well fight a fight. That's my response, because at the end of the day, I mean, you know, you can throw all the tools that you want at it, but, you know, nothing has changed. And I think, you know, any advances will be undercut or overtaken by another advance from the adversary. And, you know, also from a historical perspective, again, waxing lyrical on the philosophy, if I look at one of the biggest adversaries from the United States' perspective and you know, allied perspective, so Australia would be one of the Five Eyes in England, it doesn't take, you know, a very long record book to look at China's grudge against the Brits, for example, in Opium Wars, and there's a long memory there. Now, there's a lot of pissing each other off and, you know, defeating each other over 100 years for many, many nations. So it's also not surprising as well that any agendas exist where there's a, you know, where you've developed a nice, healthy adversary over the years. So that's my, my take.
So that's a very good segue into projecting forward.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've been, I am not a blockchain expert, although I have, you know, done some research into it, but I'm certainly not. I've not come out of university as a certified, you know, blockchain expert. And what's interesting is, you know, blockchain, if you look at some of the advertising, if you go out there and look at some companies, blockchain is now being advertised as the potential foundational layer for Web 3.0. In other words, you know, we all know that the internet will never be secure, and you secure your endpoints, you secure yourself, and you manage the risk. There is discussion within the security community as well as the blockchain community. And I'm going to set Bitcoin aside. I'm not talking about a functional application of blockchain. I'm talking about the fundamental technology of blockchain itself. There are now, let's look at Internet of Things, for example. There are a lot of discussion out there now that blockchain could be used, because blockchain is a highly decentralized capability. Yeah. In fact, decentralization is the key tenet of blockchain. And there's a lot of discussion out there now that the fundamental nature of blockchain could be used as a foundational capability to secure highly decentralized networks. The problem is, as there was noted in a recent MIT, Massachusetts Institution of Technology report that came out, blockchain itself, not Bitcoin, I'm not talking about the exchanges, which since 2008 have been severely punished through multiple attacks and successful attacks, multi-million dollar successful attacks against exchanges. Setting that aside, the foundational entity called blockchain itself has actually been successfully attacked. This takes your philosophy looking forward. What's the next technology that is sort of out there that is being postured as potentially the next solution to the cyber problem? And blockchain is currently that technology that's being discussed. Now, I do think there's a lot of possibilities there. I'm not a naysayer. I do think there's a lot of possibilities. But even blockchain, which 10 years ago was being highly regarded as a impenetrable network, is now shown that it has flaws. So, you know, I would encourage you to consider somewhere down the road have a podcast on blockchain and have your audience discuss that, you know.
that'd be fun. I'm going to get some interesting people out of the woodwork
I do think there will be technologies that are coming that will continue to help shore up some of the capabilities that we need within cyber. I certainly can give you an example. In a previous company that I was in, we were using what we called internet isolation, virtualization, as a way of not isolating necessarily the attacker, but isolating you. Mm. Our focus was on the end user and how can we minimize the surface of the end user and minimize their mistakes. Mm. In essence, if you clicked on an email and you clicked on a link and that link had a payload or that link would connect you to a command and control, we disrupted your ability to have that link actually connect back to the command and control capability by isolating your capability to communicate to the internet in the wild. Mm. So there are certain steps that can certainly be taken to lower the risk.
Yeah. It's to say it's complicated is an understatement because, you know, United States Cyber Command sits at a huge, it's got a huge scope, as we discussed in the initial portion of the podcast. But to maintain relations, and as we see currently with, say, Trump and the trade war, I mean, that's just one layer of so many that constitute an adversary, an adversary's reactions or actions to their counterpart, you know, the counter-adversary. So you can have all the tools in the world and some may be really effective today. Tomorrow, your adversary creates a tool, but a lot of that is redundant if they're not an adversary. So through diplomatic channels, through effective trade, and, you know, multiple papers, economic papers have discussed the fact that two parties with successful trade and, no trade tariffs and successful economic relations together will blossom much more than countries without those kind of agreements. That's nothing to do with cyber. But obviously, that's the cure and that's the solution to having a silver bullet in cyber. It's a lack of need. Now, that's a utopia and that's a... In this day and age, we do have adversaries, and so therefore this is going to exist, and therefore it's never going to be, in my opinion, a solution which we can 100% solve. As you bring up with blockchain, which go back 3 years ago, and I think there were already many research institutions who were looking at weaknesses. It was initially hailed as one of the game changers. It still potentially is, but no, it's not impervious. It's not impervious.
Right.
There are more.
Right.
In the silver bullet casing that was blockchain appearing. So I
find what's interesting is if and this is now focused more on the commercial sector, there's been a recent move afoot to acknowledge that, and we've all heard this, that it's not if, it's when. You know, when will you get penetrated? So therefore, what are you doing about it?
Yeah.
And over the past 10 years, there's been this nascent cyber insurance cyber risk community that has, in effect, started. Because in effect, what we're saying is you can't take risk to zero, and therefore you will always have what's called residual risk. And the residual risk you mitigate by putting a financial value on that and mitigating against that, and having a plan for what occurs when you do get attacked. Your mitigation, your PR response, how do you respond to that in public, etc. Here's the very interesting thing. Very interesting. There was a research paper that was published recently, and in effect, what they said was that the process, my focus was not on the risk. My focus was on the process of how you establish your risk. And I think some of your viewers could actually benefit from this. What is the method that you use to establish the risk on your network? There's a lot of different frameworks, a lot of different methods. This research paper addressed that. It went out and looked at how do companies and insurance companies establish what a risk is for a particular network, and then how do you put a financial value on that?
Yeah.
And here's what they found. In many cases, it was nothing more than a questionnaire. An insurance company would send you a questionnaire and say, do you do this? Do you have that? What's the type of information? Do you have financial or medical, or do you have PII, you know, personal information?
And then title, yeah.
And then they would do what's called self-attestation, and you would send that back, and they would, in effect, have some sort of math formula and put a value on that. Mm. And what the research found was, both in government as well as in industry, our ability to establish and understand the actual risk of our network is still very primitive.
Mm.
Yeah. And then the point is that's a snapshot. And then the next day it changes, your risk changes.
Yeah.
So what's interesting is there's this whole niche of companies out there now that are establishing this marketplace where they will come in and help you, no kidding, assess your risk, in effect, discover your network, benchmark your network, baseline your network, understand the controls you have in place, and then in effect, establish a risk measurement.
Yeah.
And then the tool will then evaluate that risk measurement over time and continuously update either bad or good your risk score.
Yeah.
And there's a whole market out there now that is in effect this risk-based market to help you understand, is your network risky or not, or are you over time, are you continuing to lower your risk? Mm. I find that very interesting. It's informative. I don't know how well it is in terms of the outcome so far, but I find it informative that we as a community have a very hard time with the method of even establishing the understanding of what the risk is, let alone managing the risk, putting controls in place. It's just a very, very difficult area.
Yeah, it is. It is. And you know, shifting away, as you said, from the from military into the private sector, something else that that you do see in private sector, maybe more so than you see in military and intel, just because of the level of sophistication within the, you know, to pass the litmus test to get inside the perimeter, to get your tool inside of the perimeter is arguably a bit higher in many respects. Is a lot of the hype, a lot of the marketing that's attached to, you know, I think an industry slogan is FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, which whether it's justified or not, it's, you know, the fact that it's used as part of a marketing ploy is a bugbear of many people in the industry, both on the vendor side of the fence and also the CISO or the enterprise side of the fence. I'll give you an example. I attended a webinar. It's a good webinar about how to bypass AV. And this, you know, 40 minutes worth of YouTube. And if you had some knowledge of Kali Linux platform, bing bang boom. There's my workaround that I can bypass an AV, an antivirus. And that's, you know, many of these companies are doing very good work, and they're blocking a lot of these sort of lower hanging fruit kind of threats. But realistically, if I can jump on YouTube, this isn't even a protected video, and I can jump on YouTube and look at techniques with the tool that I downloaded for free in order to bypass an antivirus, then we've got a real problem. And also the marketing, the fear, uncertainty, and doubt these vendors are shilling is kind of a moot point if you've got a slightly more motivated attacker than, you know, a run-of-the-mill, you know, pretty average crook. And I don't know that there's any easy fix for that.
So interestingly enough, I appreciate you bringing that up. I would like to provide you and your users one of my favorite quotes of all time. Seriously. So you can Google this.
Yeah.
This is back in 2008, so over 10 years ago.
Yeah.
There's a company, I think they still exist, Trend Micro.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
Trend Micro. And at that time, the CEO, who may still be the CEO, Eva Chen.
Yeah. Okay. I think she's still a CEO, yeah.
And she got in front, this is 2008, so this is 10 years ago. She got in front of a cyber conference, right? And she looked around at everybody and said, "We suck." Excuse my language. She said, seriously, go Google it. It's out there. She said, "How can we stand here? Look at the trend. You know, like I said earlier, go look at any cyber report, annual report. Look at the trend. Up, up, and up. Worse, worse, and worse. Bigger and worse malware. How can we as a community sit here at a conference and all pat ourselves on the back about what great tools?" And so when I go in and talk with CISOs and CIOs and CTOs, what they tell me is, I have enough tools, no more tools. You know, I have tool lethargy. I've got enough.
Yeah.
What I need is, I need better capabilities. I need better integration. I need better outcomes.
Yeah.
And so I am again this antagonist when it comes to the community, because I have been a customer. I've been on the government side. Remember, I was in the military, so I had a lot of tool vendors showing up. "Hey, if you just buy this tool, you know, You're going to stay ahead of the threat. So show me a use case where you can show me. I've always maintained that, you know, if you look at some of the agreements, the contracts that are written between the tool providers and customers, like a grocery store, and what some of these agreements say is, if you get successfully compromised, you cannot tell them that you have our tool. I've always been interested. Wouldn't it be interesting if a company that was attacked said, and oh, by the way, our infrastructure, we use this tool and that tool and this company and that third party, you know, security as a service provider, and none of it worked. I've always maintained that I think actually openness and transparency would be good for our community.
Yeah.
And yet in many ways, the what you talked about marketing and advertising, you know, we can help you stop advanced threats. And, you know, tool providers, and then but all of these companies out there that have been compromised were using some level of tools. It's not like they had nothing. The question is, what were they using and why didn't it work?
Yeah. It's interesting. If you ask any of the techies, and this is obviously an overgeneralization, but you ask some of the techies behind the tech, and they might give you the transparent, straight up answer. Marketing departments might jazz that up a bit and fudge some of the details. The dichotomy is that in order for a great tool, which may mitigate a lot of threats, to get out of there, oftentimes it needs to, you know, boost itself up and get itself known, because the amount of money that it takes to develop and research and build the product is so big that it needs to attach kind of marketing.
Right. Well, so what happened was, you had over the past 10 years in the security service providers and tool providers, they started to vector towards military language. And so CloudStrike comes to mind. And I'll name names, because I've talked with those guys. In fact, a previous person I know who used to be in the military was there. You see them talking about you know, attack back. You see them talking about cyber operations that we can conduct for you. You see them talking about cyber intelligence that we can conduct for you. Now, I'm not saying that it's wrong. I'm just saying that there has been this shift in marketing towards operationalization of cyber capabilities, as this marketing has been pointed out to the you know, financial community and others who simply don't know any better. And they assume that it's all correct, and they buy these tools. And what they find is that others in their industry have the same tools, and they're still getting compromised. And so it's not a very popular position, but sometimes it takes somebody like myself and you and others to question some of this and say, when I have a tool vendor that speaks to me, the first thing I ask them is, show me a use case where you can show me definitively where your tool actually stopped attacks. What kind of attacks did you prevent? Show me definitively. And most of the cases they can't, because they have NDAs in place with customers. And so I am... I'm not saying tools don't work or tools aren't good. I'm saying that there has been an overhype and an oversell, and all the banks and hospitals and other retail vendors out there who were attacked and successfully compromised, they had tools. And yet the tools didn't stop the attacks. And so I'll get off my tool platform now.
I agree with you. You know that.
Yeah. All right. So what else can we... inform your audience about?
We've touched on a lot. You know, we've gone through some, you know, certainly some of the differences between, say, military and private. We've had a look at a bit under the covers of Cyber Command, the scope of Cyber Command and how that's evolved. I think in wrapping up, probably get your sense on where are we headed. And We've just talked about this kind of stalemate that we have with reality, if that's you know, if that works as a sentence, it sounds cool. It's kind of a stalemate where we kind of accept the fact that it's going to be very bloody difficult to win. Transparency is great. Eva Chen, I'm definitely going to look up that YouTube clip. I might even try to bring her on this podcast as well.
Yeah, I'd recommend it.
Yeah. And look, I love those very refreshing discussions. But where does that leave us? So maybe a final point is, what do you envisage? What do you think is the best approach in a range of options which aren't perfect approaches?
So I think I'd go back to an area that I hit on earlier. I think if you look at some of the, if you look at, let's say like doctors, lawyers, dentists, they are not IT shops. They're not, their profession is medical, or their profession is, you know, automobile dealer, yeah, or your profession is construction company. You're not an IT company. And so what's happening is, what I have seen is the shifting in risk.
Yeah.
10 years ago, a lot of companies were in-housing their IT. They just grew it naturally. They have computers. Now they've networked them. Now they own a network. And yeah, they realized, wait a minute, I am not an IT company. I need to get out of this business. And so the risk has been shifted to the managed security providers, mm-hmm, and the cloud providers, who in effect advertise that by shifting to a managed security provider, by shifting to the cloud, you are lowering your corporate risk and you're putting that risk on us. Mm-hmm. And so the answer may be seem unusual in the sense that I think a lot of your audience might be looking for tool tips or, you know, tips on cyber operations. I look at it as fundamental business strategy first. And the fundamental business strategy, which has been occurring, is businesses have been making the decision that I want to shift the risk of IT and network, et cetera, onto somebody else. And then I will take care of the risk of the data. Mm. I will make sure that I have a good data policy in place for managing the data that I use as a part of my business. Mm. So my risk is now limited somewhat to the data. The risk of the tools, the risk of the infrastructure, I put that on somebody else.
Mm.
That's actually what I see as a significant trend. It's the business strategy, the business risk piece. Number two, I'll talk about efficiency for a second. Mm. Let's talk about SOCs and just the ability to keep up. I do believe that, and I've had this discussion, especially in the DoD community, as well as certain communities on the private sector, there is going to be an increase in efficiency by using autonomous agents and artificial intelligence to help speed up the collaboration across tool sets, the collaboration across teams that are inside of a SOC, as well as, you know, coordination and collaboration. So I think, you know, the Hey Alexa or the Hey Google or the, you know, Hey, whatever you want to call the autonomous agent, that now you will have autonomous agents that are a part of the trend of speeding up the ability to identify a vector and respond to that vector. So I think there's going to be a lot of push on efficiency, speeding up your ability to coordinate, collaborate, and respond.
Yeah.
And
like any tech, that's a double-edged sword, because you're also speeding up the efficiency to attack as well. And
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. There are artificial intelligent machine learning tools that are being used to develop malware as we speak.
Yeah. So I think the listeners, we can probably end on that, again, stoic point.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to, Nick, to have a chance to discuss what we believe are some of the important trends occurring in cyber. I would encourage your audience to consider some of these, and I appreciate and look forward to our next opportunity to get together and have a good chat.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, again, fighting the good fight, with the understanding, with pragmatism, I think is key, right? And you got to keep a sane head, but still, you know, push forward a healthy agenda so that the people that you know and the country that has got your back is in a good position. So, Steve, absolute pleasure to have you on, and I will see you somewhere in the world very soon.
Yes, sir, my pleasure.
See you later. Bye.
Cheers.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoon Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy.